You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extra, the National League West. I'm Richard Justice of MLB.com. We're going to go around the horn in the NL West with our correspondents. I think you learn a lot about clubs when they go through a stretch like this where things are not going well. And certainly it's not the first for Don Mattingly. What's the environment around the club when, you know, things have been going so great and now you're really scuffling and not taking advantage of some quality pitching? What's it like there? What's it like for Mattingly?
Yeah, the frustration is probably the best word. And as you point out, I guess if the pitching was lousy, it almost would be easier to take. But the pitching's been good enough to win if they just got any kind of support. And Greinke was a great example of that last night, as he was in his previous start. He's gone 9 starts without winning, and most of those occasions, he just isn't getting any run support. He's gotten 4 runs in the last 4 starts, another shutout performance last night, and they don't get many opportunities, and the few they get, they manage to sabotage with some mistakes, and it's just a bad combination. Everything went right for the first 6 weeks, and they were hitting all up and down the lineup, and now they've just gotten cold again all through the lineup. Outside of Justin Turner, just about everybody has cooled off one way or another, and they're just not getting it done.
Yeah, you know, Ken, it might have been sometime in April or May, I was talking to a guy with the Giants, and he goes, oh, the Dodgers, they're going to – I said, well, they've got some pitching problems. And he goes, oh, no, they're going to score a million runs. They're going to beat us. We're going to be – looking at the wild card, it's funny how things turn. But the slumps, as you said, are so up and down the lineup. Rollins, Kendrick, Agon has cooled off. Even Justin Turner's cooled off. So what do you do? Do you just, if you're the Dodgers, what are you thinking? You just ride through it?
Well, I think that's really what Mattingly was getting at yesterday, that, you know, what do you do? You know, these guys, most of them are locked in a long-term contract. It's not like you're going to tear up the team. I mean, they're in first place. You know, they're going through a tough time, but they still have been the best team in the division. And that's with things going badly for a month. So, you know, you have to decide, is this going to be permanent? And do we tear up the team at this point while you're in first place? Or do you just figure this is a temporary slump, even though it's team-wide, and that they'll come out of it? And, you know, Mattingly's position is that they'll come out of it. You've got a new front office that basically tore up the team in the offseason and rebuilt it. You can't imagine that they're going to panic and start all over again in July. I don't know really what they're going to do. There really isn't room to go out and get a lot of people. I think if there's something that they feel they really need, it would be a starting pitcher. Every team needs relief pitching, and they've had 6 relievers go on the DL at one point or another during the season. So, I think that they're basically, this is their club, and they have to win with it outside of 1 or 2 additions. So, you hope that the Puig stays healthy and comes back strong, you know, and he's back in the lineup, but he hasn't been driving in runs. You hope that Adrian, gets hot again, you know, but there isn't a lot of protection when nobody else is hitting. You got Scott Peterson up at the top of the lineup hitting home runs, you know, but his average is down below 250. So, you know, there's a lot of warts all over the place.
Jimmy Rollins is now 36 years old, and I guess he was brought in to be a 1-year buffer between Hanley and Corey Seager. He's not hitting. He's hitting. He's hit some lately, but his average is 207. Do you think that Andrew Friedman and Farhan Zaidi and all, are they having a real conversation about, is this Corey Seager's time? Or do you think, no, we brought in Jimmy for defense, for leadership, for more than the bat? What do you think is going on in that area?
Well, I think that the question is, if you bring up Corey Seager and you make that change and he's not ready, then what? You know, if you're going to make that change, are you going to ask Jimmy Rollins to sit on the bench? How's that going to work out? If you release him, what backstop is there if Seager struggles? And now Seager was moved up from AA to AAA, and for 3 weeks he struggled. He struggled for 3 weeks at AAA where it really doesn't matter. But if he struggles 3 weeks in the major leagues with your team fighting for first place, it matters. You know, and what will that do to his progression? So those are the things that a front office has to deal with. And obviously, if they had felt that, that the time had come for Seager to come up, it would have happened already, but it hasn't. So obviously, they're struggling with that. They want to give him as much foundation as they can. You know, they rushed Puig up, and he made a big impact a few years ago. But also in rushing him up, he missed some foundation, and his fundamentals are lacking. So, you know, you have to weigh that part of the equation, too. So, you know, it could happen tomorrow, or maybe it won't happen until the end of August. Who knows?
So the other thing, it seems like we have this conversation every year. They have too many outfielders. Is Carl Crawford is not going to be the left fielder. I think Donnie's made that clear that Ethier's earned the chance to play in the platoon and all that. How do you think, is it going to be awkward sitting Crawford on the bench? Or do you think they would pick up the money and move him? Where does Carl Crawford stand now in the pecking order?
Well, that's always awkward. And it was awkward all last year with Ethier, but they went through it. And, you know, the team didn't collapse because of it. There was no brawls about it. There's going to be an unhappy player. You know, there's going to be a lot of them. Alex Guerrero's unhappy sitting on the bench not playing. And Mattingly feels that he's his best pinch hitter, and that's the best role for him. So he's got an unhappy player there. If Carl Crawford comes back and starts every day after the way Andre Ethier played, you're going to have Andre Ethier unhappy on the bench. But if you trade either of them, and somebody gets hurt, and Puig's already been out, you know, you're shorthanded. So, you know, I think that while it's never good to have an unhappy player, that wasn't the reason that they didn't force them to make a move during last season. They made one during the offseason in that camp, but they had another replacement ready in their minds, in Jock Peterson. And I just don't see them feeling they're forced to make a move if they feel that it cuts into their depth. So someone is going to be unhappy on the bench, and it may be Carl Crawford initially. But as we've seen with these outfielders, at least with the Dodgers, they all tend to get hurt. So you never really have too many.
And Ken, long-term, where do they see Guerrero and Oliveira playing when they are – well, Oliveira's hurt now, but where do they play?
Well, Guerrero, it's pretty clear. They don't feel he's going to play anywhere. He's a bench player. And they don't feel comfortable with him playing every day in the field anywhere. Okay, so that they've sort of taken care of that, you know, except for Guerrero's unhappiness. Oliveira is an interesting question. Clearly, next year he will be either the third baseman or the second baseman. This year, you know, my guess is that Donnie will go with whoever's hot, and especially with the offense being the way it is now. If Oliveira heals up, they feel he's ready, they bring him up and he hits, he'll play. They'll find a place for him to play. He'll catch, he'll pitch. It doesn't matter if he can hit, he'll find a place, especially with the lineup the way it is now. And then next year, he will be a starter at either second or third base. So, you know, right now with the way the bats are, they don't have too many of anything. So anybody who comes up and wants to drive in runs, they're going to find a spot in the lineup for him.
And one last thing. After all this we talked about, problem here, problem there, you still see this as the best team in the NL West, don't you?
Well, I think they're the most talented, but they don't always play like the best team. And they've got, you know, you talk about warts in the lineup. They're not winning on the road, and they're not beating good teams. So they've got two flaws there that they've got to improve on if they really want to go all the way. So, you know, they were the best road team in the game last year, and they're not this year. So they need to fix that. And every time they run into a solid pitcher, their offense goes to sleep. So they've got two big issues that they've got to deal with right there. And if they can solve that, then, yes, they're the best team in the league.
Well, if it were easy, everyone would do it, I guess. You know, just as I was waiting for you to come on the line here, I had a brainstorm, but this might be one of Bruce Bochy's greatest managing jobs, in that they start badly, you know, you have the even year, odd year thing, people doubting them, everybody's picking the Padres. One guy after another gets hurt, and lo and behold, we look up and the Giants have scrambled back. What did they have, a 9-game home losing streak, something like that? They're still a game out of first. In times like this, when you're going through, when everything's breaking down, parts are flying off the car one at a time, what do you learn about the greatness of Mr. Bochy?
You know, Richard, he's done a lot of things. He's, number one, he's patient as heck. He does not rattle. I'm sure he goes through times of stress, but he never lets, as the saying goes, he never lets you see him sweat. And I think he's been through so much in this game that he really doesn't sweat. One thing that's really struck me this year, and maybe it has to do with some of the personal things, like, you know, getting the stents put in his heart to, you know, make sure that happened early in spring training and, you know, something he absolutely physically needed. But he, win or lose, you know, 9-game home losing streak or, you know, 5-game road winning streak, whatever's happening, his sense of humor has come through almost every day, you know, sitting with the writers, which isn't an easy thing. You know, a lot of managers regard, you know, their sessions with us as, you know, an obligation, something to get through, a chore, like doing the laundry or washing the, you know, cleaning the hubcaps or something. But you know, he seems like he lets himself have fun. And I think, he's doing that with his team. I've noticed that a little more this year than in previous years. And I think it just speaks to his overall balance.
And Chris, is there a feeling, do you have this feeling, maybe Brian Sabian and Boch have this feeling, that if the Giants ever get their pieces back on the field, you know, some years that never happens, this is still the best team in the NL West, or how do they look at it?
That's never been articulated, but I think they know that, you know, they have the horses. They have them pitching. Right now they're kind of, you know, just wondering how to juggle this pitching. They do have some depth, although, you know, they're not really sure of the quality of the depth because they're not sure how Jake Peavy and Matt Cain are going to come back from their injuries, which is going to happen pretty soon. But I think there's enough season left to where if they have to, you know, make, no matter how many changes they'll need to make, they should be able to make them to their satisfaction.
And Chris, so Peavy and Cain, I take it, will be back within a week or so, or maybe less than that. And who is safe in the rotation in your mind other than Bumgarner? Chris Heston has pitched very well at times. How do you think they're looking at the pecking order now as they make room for those two guys? And do you think Peavy goes in the rotation too? I guess I'm asking you to speculate on what happens with the two guys, with seven starters now.
Right. Well, they're going to give Peavy and Cain their chances. And Bruce has already mentioned dates for them to come back, not really a particular guy, but July 2nd and July 3rd. One of them will get one date, the other one will get the other. Now, as to who comes out, you know, I don't want to cop out and say, I don't know. I'd love to give you some sort of answer, but what Bruce has implied is that they may do some creative stuff with the off days they have almost every week. You know, they can maybe do something where, you know, somebody like a Tim Hudson or a Tim Lincecum maybe skips a couple starts but gets reinstalled in the rotation. It'll almost be like a basketball type of rotation, you know, using seven men to fill five spots.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the strengths of the Giants during this great run is they almost never shortened their rotation, did they? They liked giving pitchers a day off, so that would make some sense. As you watch Tim Lincecum, he's coming off a real tough start at Dodger Stadium. What's going on with this guy? Is this what Timmy is now? He's a guy that's got to be very precise down in the strike zone, and you just don't know what you're going to get start to start. I don't think he's gone six innings one time this month. What's your feeling on Tim Lincecum?
You kind of summed it up right there. You know, he has to be precise. I think he's capable. I really do believe he's capable of still being an above-average pitcher. We've seen it from him this year. But, yes, he has to be down in the strike zone. He's got to get the good movement on his off-speed pitches, spot the fastball really well. And for all that to happen, he has to have solid pitching mechanics, and his motion is so many combinations, so many moving parts. When one little thing is off, boom, boom, out go the lights. It's not good for him. So he has to be, really synchronized to succeed.
How has Hunter Pence taken not playing? You know, the guy I know is so hyper. I mean, it's hard for me. I imagine he would be a pain in the butt in the dugout in the clubhouse when he's not playing. Is he accepting this and just saying, hey, I got to get healthy again, and when I get healthy, fine? And when will that be, do you think?
Yeah, outwardly, he's fine. I think inwardly, he is going nuts, as you're thinking he would. Exactly when he might come back, that's a good question. Bruce Bochy said yesterday that he expects Hunter to start doing, performing baseball-related activities this weekend. So I would think maybe within a couple of weeks after that, maybe 3 weeks. But, you know, it's possible that the Giants will not see him before the All-Star break.
And, you know, Chris, we're talking about all these things that are negative. And you and I both know, even though it is an odd-numbered year, that in September, Crawford, Belt, Pagan, Maxwell, Timmy, they're all going to get going, and the Giants are going to end up winning the World Series again. Maybe not, but you can see it happen. And there's so many guys on that roster that have been through it before that there's every reason to be confident. I mean, they know the race is not won in June, and so you just soldier on. That's the strength of the Giants, right?
Yeah, by now their confidence is pretty established, I'd say. They don't take it for granted, I don't think, because in baseball, I don't know if there are any supremely talented, supremely accomplished teams anymore. They know they can play with anybody. They know they can beat pretty much anybody. They play up to their competition a lot. You know, sometimes they play down their competition. And the nature of the division is that, that keeps them going too. They have to play hard to be a San Diego, which they did not do last night, or an Arizona. So it's a good competitive division for them to be in.
Yeah. Well, Chris, great stuff. I look forward to reading your coverage in America's Most Beautiful City, from America's Most Beautiful City. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Richard.
So, Corey, Pat Murphy, what's the change in style, tone? What's the difference in you covered one guy, Buddy Black, for so long. We all love the guy. What's the difference in Pat Murphy?
Yeah, I guess I might be better apt to answer this in a couple months, Richard. But, just from afar and having dealt with Murph before when he was a AAA manager and talking with guys that passed through Tucson or El Paso, wherever their AAA affiliate was, you got the impression this was a guy who was intense, kind of has a, I think they say has a rah-rah demeanor. That sounds kind of sophomoric. But, we have to understand that Pat's background was largely in college baseball, Notre Dame, Arizona State, most notably, before he got into the pro ranks. So I think it's safe to think that a lot of that has sort of bled over. And, I think he's kind of going through this process as the players are, as a kind of a discovery process, trying to feel each other out here. This interim gig is a tough gig. You're no guarantees of anything beyond this year. So
I think the players are finding out what Pat's all about, and Pat's finding out about the players. I mean, the strategy stuff, Richard, the stuff between the lines, knowing when to go to the bullpen, that all kind of plays out mostly the same, really, no matter what level you're at. But this job is about managing people. And, it's going to take him a while to sort of get up to speed, but he's upbeat. He's quick with the one-liner. He's really enjoying this. He's kind of got this gleam in his eye that, he's kind of taken all this in. He was at AT&T Park on Tuesday for the first time ever. And I saw him walking around with his 13-year-old son, Kai, and just kind of checking out the ballpark, taking things in. He went over and shook hands with Hunter Pence because he was a guy he really admired. This is it's kind of like a rookie coming up for the first time.
The Padres are hitting 230 this month, if my math is correct. Kemp, Norris, Justin Upton is struggling. Melvin Upton hasn't got it going when he played. And Middlebrooks is struggling. Is this just the sort of thing? Or does A.J. Preller have options? Or there are so many guys not hitting now, you just have to, hey, you got to bulldoze through. We'll come out of this. The bubblegum cords say they'll hit at some point. So let's just keep going. How do you think A.J. and Pat look at it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you have to lean on, for better or worse, you have to lean on past experiences and track record and resume of some of these guys, you know, thinking that they're going to come around at some point. And, you know, Derek Norris and Justin Upton, they both struggled in the month of June. They were pretty good those first 2 months. Matt Kemp, his struggles certainly have been well chronicled by now. I think, you know, this is the team you have right now. And I think these next few weeks are absolutely critical for the Padres in terms of, you know, can they make a move in the West? You know, they're still within arm's reach of the top of the division. You know, at one point, Richard, I thought the Dodgers were just on the cusp of just running away with this thing completely. But the Giants got hot. They finally started hitting for the first time since I've ever watched them. And, you know, the Padres kind of treading some water, kind of hanging back there a little bit, but believing that the guys they have in the clubhouse right now, if they're going to make any move, they're going to have to do it with these guys. So, you know, we may reach a point, if we talk a month from now, Richard, that, you know, the Padres have to really have a, you know, what I like to say is a come-to-Jesus meeting where you have to decide moving forward, are you going to sell some of these pieces and recoup some prospects and take a step back to move forward? But that's an awfully, awfully tough pill to swallow for a franchise that made such big marquee moves and kind of a win-now mentality and moved a lot of very good prospects to get these players.
Corey, what's going on with Andrew Cashner this season?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, in my time in San Diego since 07, he's thrown some of the most electric, some of the most dominant games really in franchise history, if you look at it from that perspective. Kyle Tucker, one-hitters in the past where this stuff is just dynamite. And you know, I it's really tough to say. You know, command's been a miss early on in the year. He was kind of a victim of poor run support, and he'd pitched pretty well. But lately, the command has been a little bit a miss. You know, this has been a tough year for him with his mom, you know, fighting through leukemia. He would never point at that. You know, and he is a guy that continues to search for answers and watches video and really bears down with pitching coach Darren Balsley to try and get some stuff figured out. I seem to think the stuff is still pretty good. The fastball's still electric. The secondary pitches are pretty good. I think it's just a matter of command at this point and getting ahead of guys and then burying them. But he hasn't done that very much lately. But, you know, I have to think there's still a good pitcher in there.
Well, what do you think is in Melvin Upton Jr.'s head right now? And is there any playing time for him there, even with Myers out? What's his role? And have you seen any signs that, hey, this guy's going to snap out of it? There was a time when he was a really good player. What's the state of Melvin Upton Jr.?
Yeah, and you're right. With Will Myers now out for a couple months, he's going to get a chance to play and play a lot. You know, we're going to see Will Venable in there a little bit. He had a big hit against the Giants, against Bumgarner, lefty on lefty, to get them back in a game. And, you know, Will's kind of quietly put together a decent year, especially the role he's been given. So, you know, they've been running Melvin out there. You know, he got the month or so with the AAA team to kind of get his timing down and coming back from the foot injury he had in the spring. They're rolling him out there, and I think they're trying to see exactly what they have. And, you know, I guess the sample size that I've seen so far isn't nearly big enough to make a blanket statement on where he's going to be. But, you know, so far, the quality of at-bats, I'm sure, and he would agree, haven't been that good. He's been hitting at the top of the order. You know, I don't know if you're required to take a lot of pitches there. I think it's nice, certainly, for the rest of the guys in the order to get on base. But he hasn't been doing that. So we'll see moving forward. You know, I have to – you know, when they made this move, Richard, I was a head-scratcher for me. I understand you wanting to get Kimbrel. I'm completely on board with that. It's important to have a lockdown closer, especially in the National League, in a division where runs can be scarce sometimes in these big ballparks. I get that, but, you know, you had to take on Melvin Upton to get him, and I just don't know what you do with the remainder of that contract and the player beyond this year.
Corey, with all these new guys, has there been a leader emerge in the clubhouse, multiple leaders? Who's running the show in there? Or I don't know if I'm saying that the right way, but you know what I mean. There's usually a first among equals at times. And what is the state of the Padres in that way?
Yeah, and I will say, you know, to Bud Black's credit, well, in a lot of regards, and we don't have nearly enough time to go into that, but, you know, one of the things he impressed upon two newcomers, James Shields and Matt Kemp, before spring training is, hey, I want you guys to be leaders. You guys have lengthy service time. You guys have been through the wars. You guys have played in the postseason. I want you guys to be leaders. And then to a man, you know, they told him they would. And, you know, you see some of that. It's hard for us, and even in the press, you know, where we're in the clubhouse before and after games. But I know those guys took that torch up and ran with it early in the year. And Shields especially, a real kind of a vocal guy, and not beating my chest, you know, do as I say, do as I do. But these guys have different ways of kind of getting a message across. So I think those are the two guys right now that are sort of looked at as leaders, even though this is their first year with the team. And that's, you know, usually that role kind of falls on someone who has a little bit more track record in terms of time with the Padres. Well, when you turn over half the roster, that's sort of hard to come by. So, but I would say those two. I would say Kemp and Shields.
It's a real defining time, or possibly a defining time for the Padres. 18 out of 23 on the road leading up to the break. And you're in San Francisco as we speak. Then they will later, before the break, go to St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and Texas. So we'll know, by the time the All-Star break gets here, we'll know a lot more about the Padres. And so it'll be interesting. Look forward to reading your coverage, Corey, and thank you as always. Steve, before we get to the trade and the search for pitching and all that stuff, I just want to ask you about Paul Goldschmidt. He's 27 years old. He's made the last two All-Star games, almost won an MVP 2 years ago. And just when you think, you know, you've seen the best of Paul Goldschmidt, he gets even better. I mean, just looking at his numbers, they're insane how good this guy is. I mean, this guy's approaching a 500 home base percentage. This is Bond territory. As you cover him day-to-day and you've gotten to know him through the years, well, what are the things about Paul Goldschmidt that most impress you?
I think, Richard, you know, it's the mental side of the game for him, and I recently wrote a story about it. It's his desire to get better on a daily basis. And when you talk to people around the Diamondbacks, you know, whether it be coaches, other players, management, they'll tell you that being around Paul Goldschmidt makes you want to be better because he is so committed to improving every day in some way, you know, and he's constantly asking questions. He's constantly trying to pick up little things. You know, he's stolen double digit bases because he studies opposing pitchers so that he can pick up a stolen base here and there that might help the team score an extra run. He just does those things, those little things. He's constantly trying to improve. The mental side of the game for him right now is big because he said, you know, physically at age 27, he's probably not going to get any better from a physical standpoint. So for him right now, he feels like that the biggest thing he can do is continue to improve mentally in his approach to the game and picking up things around the game.
Steve, you think some of this was born, I'm fairly close to Matt Carpenter and Alan Craig, and they both went through this. Do you think some of this was born of being an eighth-round draft pick that he felt he had to overprove himself? Or do you think, hey, this is just who the kid is? The kid wants to get every ounce of baseball there is out of his talent.
I think it's more the latter. He doesn't ever seem to be motivated by perceived slights because I don't think he really pays attention. He's one of the few players that doesn't have a Twitter account. He, you know, goes out of his way to not read stuff that's written about the Diamondbacks. He tends to read the business section of the newspaper, and he'll glance at the sports section, but he doesn't know what people are writing about him because he doesn't feel like, again, that'll help him get better on any given day or help him in his dealings with the media on a daily basis if he knows specifically what they're writing about him. So, but, you know, certainly he went to a not necessarily a baseball power at Texas State University, and he was just a guy that kind of was overlooked in a lot of ways. through the whole draft process.
And one, just one last thing on Goldie. He understands that he's a role model, I take it, in his work for the community and being the face of the franchise and all that stuff. I take it in talking to him, he takes that part of it seriously. Am I right?
Yeah, he really does, and he's aware that people pay attention, the kids pay attention to what it is that he does, and it's very rare to see him say anything to an umpire. Certainly, you never see him be demonstrative with an umpire. He's just very aware that he has a responsibility. He and his wife do a lot for the Phoenix Children's Hospital, things that he doesn't like to talk about publicly or doesn't want cameras following him around publicly. But you're right, he does. And to raise money for Phoenix Children's Hospital, he had this fundraiser where they sold the Bleacher Creature dolls, likenesses of himself, which was really hard for him to approve because he doesn't like to promote himself. And so to have his doll out there with his likeness was something that was difficult for him. But when he realized they could raise some significant money for the hospital, for the children's hospital, he agreed to go along with it.
Yeah, the Diamondbacks made a fascinating trade this week, or I guess it was last week, in trading the young kid, the 19-year-old first-round draft pick from a year ago, Tuki Toussaint, to the Braves and they traded Bronson Arroyo's contract. I guess and Bronson Arroyo went with the contract, I assume, for an infielder, Phil Gosselin. And I think that your initial reaction is, this was a salary dump, and it probably was. But I guess the second part of that is, and Tony La Russa was pretty adamant in telling you, let's see what we do with the money. We think we have a chance to win now, and we're going to use that money and the Mark Trumbo money to improve the club. Having had a few days to think about it, what is your analysis of what the Diamondbacks attempted to do?
Well, I think, Richard, it's a fascinating kind of trade. You just don't see it happen very often. It's almost as though the Braves kind of purchased the Tuki Toussaint from the Diamondbacks. Tony La Russa and Dave Stewart were adamant that the money that they saved, around $10 million, was not just something that was going to go into, the owner's pockets or just disappear. It was going to be something that they were going to hold in reserve. Or if they felt like there was a move to be made towards the end of the towards the trade deadline this year, or maybe during the offseason heading into next year. So I think it's your snap judgment is to say give up a first round draft pick, but I think we need to give it some time to see what they do with the actual money savings that they made got in the deal to be able to fully evaluate it in perspective.
Okay, from a practical standpoint, if they had their druthers, would they go out and add a starting pitcher or just try to shore up the bullpen? I know they need both, and I guess the second part of that question is, where are they with Archie Bradley and Patrick Corbin pitching again?
Maybe two more rehab starts before they take a look at it and decide if he's ready to be activated. So he could be coming soon. How much they can realistically expect of him. I know they want to be real careful with him coming off Tommy John. They want to be, they don't want to look at him as like a savior and overwork him this year. So it'd be interesting to see how much he's able to contribute in the second half of the season. As for Archie, he just now has started back out on the rehab program. He's going to have to prove himself, whereas Patrick Corbin's going to have to show that he's healthy and his elbow is healthy. They want Archie Bradley to show some success as well because he had so many struggles in his previous four starts right before he went on the disabled list. So he's going to have to earn his way back onto that roster. So he's got a dual role there in terms of getting his shoulder back to being 100% and also showing that he can be the pitcher he was for his first three starts of the year when he was put up really, really good numbers before he got hit in the face.
So in terms of upgrading the club, they would just go for any kind of pitching, or would they prefer a starter? How does Tony and Dave look at it?
I think they would prefer a starter at this point, but they do like some of the young pitching that they have coming up, and they do have Corbin coming back. They do have Archie coming back. So it's going to be interesting to see, how big a buyers they are at the trade deadline, if they're just kind of looking for a small improvement and kind of banking on, you know, next year kind of being the year to make a big push, you know, maybe during the off season with the crop of pitchers that's going to be out there on the market, or if they decide to go all in here and really, you know, make a trade for a big time starter before the trade deadline.
Chase Anderson has had an interesting year, and I love watching him pitch, in that he seems to be a pitcher. What is the evolution of him? And when Dave Duncan and Dave and those guys got there, what did they see that they liked about Chase Anderson? And does he, at 27 years old, do they see him as a long-term part of the pitching staff?
You know, he's another guy that that wasn't a high draft pick. He doesn't wow you with his with radar gun reading. But he's a very steady pitcher, and he's a guy that when he goes out there, most times you know what you're going to get out of him, and that's a very valuable thing in today's game. And I think, you know, they've worked with him a little bit more on throwing a two-seam fastball. That's a Dave Duncan specialty. So he's used that with quite a bit of success this year. That's helped him. I think they do see him as a long-term part of that rotation, because he's a guy that they think year in and year out is going to be a consistent guy that puts up innings, which with the way the rotation was going earlier this year, it was helpful to know at least when he went out there, he was going to give you six innings. So, yeah, I think he's a guy that while he might not wow you with his stuff, pure stuff, his ability to pitch and his approach on the mound is something that they like a lot.
Do you think Tony and Dave and Ken Kendrick, the whole gang there, do you think they're surprised to be two under, or is this what they thought they had, a club that would scrap and, you know, and hang around and have a chance?
I don't think they're as surprised as the rest of us are. I think, you know, Tony had said last year at the GM meetings before they started making some of the moves that they made, you know, before the Tomas signing, before the Hellickson trade, before all that stuff, Tony told us he'd be heartbroken if they weren't at least 500 in 2015, which surprised a lot of us considering how, you know, how much they struggled last year with the worst record in baseball. So I think for them, maybe they always expected to be right around this spot. I think for the rest of us, kind of figured that, you know, maybe they'd be a little worse off than they are now, and that this was just going to be kind of a year of growth for them. But certainly Chip Hale has them playing hard night in and night out and right around the 500 mark, which I think, given where they were last year, that's a pretty big accomplishment for this organization.
Yeah, it's a fun team to watch. The center fielder, Pollock, is a terrific player. Thomas, I want to start by asking you about Kyle Kendrick, and he's given up a lot of home runs, most in baseball. But he seems, and just based on what you've written and all, he seems to have a good attitude about it, a thick skin about it. A couple of things about him. What did the Rockies think they were getting in this guy, and how is this a Coors Field thing, or how is he handling a rough season?
I'll tell you what, the Rockies have brought in a number of veteran types thinking that they would be able to handle Coors Field and all of the effects, the ball not breaking as well, sometimes traveling farther. And quite often it's ended in a mess. I mean, I remember Jeremy Guthrie a few years ago. He was here, and he was ready to get out of here within a month. Kyle Kendrick, he gave up a lot of home runs in Philadelphia, so it doesn't bother him as badly. And he talked about it last night. He got his first Coors Field win, and he said that the issue is it's hard to determine how your breaking stuff and even how your fastball is going to work here on a start-by-start basis. But he's not the type who's going to run from that. Did they expect better out of him? Yes. And has he given up home runs on the road? Yes. But as far as what the Rockies wanted, they realized they weren't going to get a top-level pitcher on the market. Those guys just don't come here, and the spending would be pretty prohibitive. But what they wanted was a professional, a guy who can handle the ups and downs. And I will tell you, from spring training on, he is one of the most professional guys that you could ever meet in this game. I mean, the way that he has worked with some of the younger pitchers, the way he's kind of bought into the Colorado Rockies and an understanding of where they're trying to get to, understanding that they may not be there yet, but if they pull everything together, they've got a chance. I mean, I've not seen very many people that really handled being with the Rockies who didn't come up through the organization. I've not seen very many people handle it better than Kyle Kindry.
And Thomas, part of what you said basically, you know, is that the Rockies probably have to develop their own. And off that, Eddie Butler has a tough ERA in the minor leagues. What's up with Eddie Butler? You know, because in my mind, we think of Eddie Butler and Jonathan Gray as sort of bookends. These are the guys that are going to anchor the rotation at some point. But Eddie's having a tough time of it. Do you know what's going on with him?
Yes. When he was here in the majors, well, let's go back to him being here to start this season. If you look at the history of the Rockies, very rarely have they had a pitcher skip the AAA level. And they called up Butler last year because of injuries and non-performance. He literally was all they had, even though he had a shoulder problem that brought him up to the major leagues. Well, in spring training, after going out in deals, the Rockies didn't want to have Eddie Butler on the rotation. But David Hale, who's in the rotation now, he came in a trade with the Braves. Looks like he may be able to handle this. What happened to Hale? Strained an oblique muscle late in camp, so it pretty much solidified that Eddie Butler was going to be in the rotation. Keep in mind, this is a guy who, other than a rehab start last year, had not pitched at the AAA level. So he really hadn't harnessed all of his stuff. What we saw here was a guy who had a fight in him, and he had a pretty heavy fastball when he used it properly, but the fastball and the secondary stuff, there wasn't a whole lot of separation in the speeds, and big league hitters were destroying it. So actually, what's happening here is he's getting the AAA education that John Gray got at the start of the season. If you look at John Gray's last 10 or 11 starts, they've been outstanding. But the first three or four starts were borderline awful because he hadn't gotten out the hitters of that experience level. Then he turned out to be pretty good. There isn't a fear that Eddie Butler is going to crumble under this, but it's pretty clear that what's going to happen is he's going to have to complete his education as a pitcher. It's not just throwing a fastball, four-seam fastball and a sinker and a slider. It's how do you separate the speeds but keep your arm speed the same? All the stuff that goes with good pitching that a lot of times you just have to simply do in games, and it's very hard to do it at the big league level where the hitters are so good.
And Thomas, so John Gray has a 4.5 ERA at Albuquerque, but he's been good the last month. How much longer for him? How much longer does his education begin now permanently at Coors Field?
And it's funny. I've been kind of asking some questions about that, and he hasn't been determined as ready. Like I say, right now, in the Pacific Coast League, I don't look a whole lot at ERAs because you can have one or two games that are just completely crazy and they blow up the ERA. But what I've seen the last 10 starts or so with him is that he's getting those hitters out. But it's my understanding he is still working on his off-speed pitches. His changeup has come along. You would like to see just a better changeup, a changeup that hitters don't pick up when he gets to this level. The slider came along, and that was a very good pitch for him in college, but it took a while for him to be able to use it at this level with the number of starts that you have and everything else. It looks like that's come along pretty well. I think once those pitches are deemed, yeah, that's fine, then they can call him up. I mean, it's a situation right now where, let's face it, as tight as the NL West is, the Rockies are, as we speak here, 8 games below 500, but they're only 7 games back. But still, at 8 games below 500, you don't reach in and grab a guy saying, hey, he may not be ready, but let him come up here and just sling some fastballs and get us through some games. That's not what you do at this point. You want to make sure that he has a chance of success here, and you want to get to the point to where you call him up and you don't have to send him back. I mean, they did that with Butler because they had to, but this is a case where they weren't going to do it with two guys this season.
And, Thomas, Chad Bettis has been one of the real good news guys. It seems like at age 27, he's sort of come of age, 26, he's sort of come of age this year. How did he learn? What was the most impressive thing to you in watching this kid become a big league starting pitcher?
Well, I'll tell you, just the comeback from last year. I mean, last year he had a, 9.12 ERA in the bullpen, and then they finally moved him back to the rotation. But what happened, if you go back to spring training, they did not put him in games in the early part of spring training. They just had him working on his mechanics and getting back to where he was. When he was drafted out of Texas Tech, this was a guy who looked like a fast mover through the system. Then he basically missed a year with a shoulder issue. The next year he came back, and just on raw talent, he ended up in the big leagues. But from the effect of the shoulder issue was he started letting some changes seep into his mechanics. When the new pitching coaches here, Steve Foster and Darren Holmes, looked at him, they even went back to his college days at Texas Tech, and they're like, wait a minute, this is a different pitcher. What happened here? And when I talked to Chad Bettis, he wasn't really sure how he seeped out of his mechanics. But once they started working with him, getting his momentum going back to home plate, suddenly he felt like himself again. And this is a guy, and he's one of the types of guys that you really need at Coors Field, and that he struggled. His numbers looked really bad last season. And basically not being allowed in games early, people were questioning, gee, is this guy even a major league pitcher? But he's come back from that because he has just a lot of mental toughness, and that's what you need. And I'm looking to see if this team does come together in this season or in the coming years, where he fits in, because he seems to have that right attitude that you'd like to have in a guy who's developed by the Colorado Rockies.
Yeah, and so if you look at, let's just say, Hale, Bettis, Jordan Lyles will pitch again at some point, Butler, Gray. I mean, it's a pretty good arsenal of a pretty good core of a young pitching staff, right? I mean, they have to feel good about the pitching they accumulated and the pitching they just drafted, I would think, right?
Yeah. They feel very good about that. And don't forget about Tyler Chatwood, who pitched very well for them two seasons ago and looked like he was going to have a good year last year, but he blew out his MCL and ended up having the Tommy John surgery. He's getting close to facing hitters, but really you're talking about next year for him. If you look at what's happened in the last couple of drafts, and also the Gray Butler and the guys that accumulated that are at the major league level, they've got a chance to have decent pitching for a while here. It's just a matter of making sure those guys develop and also crossing your fingers you don't have the injuries which always seem to occur.
Our friend Tracy Ringlesby wrote about Nolan Arenado today, and in my career, I've had to just watch guys. I just had I was an honor, like Murray and Ripken and Bagwell and Biggio, Bergman. Do you feel that way about watching Arenado, like you're seeing the coming out of a star right in front of your eyes? His defense is just fantastic. His offense is terrific. This guy is going to be a special player for a while now, isn't he?
Yeah, and I sensed it when he first came up, and I'll tell you why. Here is a guy, when he was drafted in the second round, I was kind of familiar with his story. Really excellent hitter out of high school, but people weren't sure what position he would play. He played shortstop in high school, but they drafted him as a third baseman, and there were people who actually thought he doesn't move well enough to play third base. Now, think about that now. He doesn't move well enough to play third base. He's going to have to be a catcher, a slugging-type catcher. Well, obviously, he developed the third base, and very quickly. And when he got here, the glove was ahead of his bat. And so I thought back, gee, this was the guy drafted for his bat. Imagine what happens when the rest of it comes along. And this is what we're starting to see. We're starting to see a star player emerge right before our eyes.
That's just great. Thanks for listening. This has been MLB.com Extras, the National League West.